you. Board Member Hanson.
One of the benefits of going last is I have nothing new to say, but nonetheless, I will say it anyway. I'd like to join my fellow board members in thanking the staff for their thoughtful efforts in developing the recommendations today. The rules we're adopting today will enable the board to commence in a timely fashion its oversight of the auditors of brokers and dealers. At the same time, the interim inspection program will allow time for new rules and standards related to broker-dealer audits to evolve and the board to consider an appropriate scope and approach for permanent broker-dealer oversight. Moreover, the rules will close the gap that remained after the requirement for broker-dealers to register with us but not be inspected, which none of us could really rationalize how that made any sense. I also support the recommended approach in providing transparency over the board's interim oversight activities by issuing annual summary reports rather than publishing the individual firm inspection reports. This approach strikes an appropriate balance. It gives investors and the public insight into the board's activities and observations during the interim inspection program while allowing the board and the auditors of broker-dealers to focus during this transition period on adapting to a changing framework rather than the nuances of drafting and responding to public inspection reports. Related to the introducing broker-dealers, which we've talked a lot today about, several of the comments received by the board address the question of whether or not the board's interim inspection program should include inspections of auditors of introducing brokers and dealers that do not maintain customer cash and securities. Commenters who oppose the inclusion of introducing broker-dealers in the board's interim inspection program argued that the risk to the investors presented by introducing broker-dealers is low, while the regulatory burden stemming from the PCAOB inspections of these auditors is high. Supporters of the rule considered today believe the risks are substantial enough to justify PCAOB oversight over the auditors of broker-dealers. Similar arguments were made when Congress considered the scope of the broker-dealer oversight provisions in the Dodd-Frank Act. Congress ultimately decided to give the board the responsibility of determining the appropriate scope for its broker-dealer audit inspection program. While the risk presented to investors by the activities of introducing broker-dealers may be lower than those presented by carrying or clearing brokers, risks do exist. Auditors have a role to play in providing assurances that those risks are minimized, including confirming that these brokers and dealers are not exceeding the scope of permissible activities. In order for the board to appropriately balance the risks presented by introducing broker-dealers against the effectiveness and costs of PCAOB oversight, the board must gain a full understanding of the role played by the auditors of all broker-dealers in addressing the potential risks to investors. I agree that the best way for the board to gather the relevant information is to inspect for a time the auditors of all classes of brokers and dealers. Nevertheless, I wish to emphasize, as others have today, that the board is mindful of the concerns expressed about the potential regulatory burden associated with PCAOB oversight. We have not made any judgments about the appropriate scope of a permanent inspection program. The board intends to include in the interim inspection program a sufficient number and variety of firms to permit the board to gather the necessary information while avoiding unreasonable costs for brokers and dealers and their auditors and ultimately investors. We will also continue to consult with the SEC, FINRA, and others who share the board's investor protection mandate in order to consider the role of auditor regulation against the backdrop of direct regulation over brokers and dealers. So I just have two questions that I don't think have been covered today, and I'll really address this one to Helen and Bob, and that's, You mentioned the how we're going to select and the overall scope, but for the smaller broker dealers that have not previously been subject to our oversight, that some of them might be so small they might not even have offices or office space for us to send a team in. So what types of things do we do to accommodate those smaller broker dealers, and what are the ways we conduct those inspections?
Our inspections are always scaled to the size and scope of what it is that we are looking at. And we would expect that the interim program would include a certain number of PCOB-based inspections, as we do with small auditors of issuers.
So wait, PCAOB-based. Aren't all inspections PCOB-based? What does that mean?
Well, in a PCOB-based inspection, we do not travel to the offices of the audit firm. The audit firm would send us the relevant work, and we would look at it in our offices and have phone conversations or video conferences with the audit firm in question. We found that to be very effective in doing inspections of issuers in certain instances, and would think it could work well for certain of these firms. For others of these firms, we would plan to travel to their offices and meet with them in person in order to understand, up close and personal, I guess, the way they approach their audits and their quality control systems.
And for any given smaller auditor or smaller broker-dealer, does this process take like days or weeks or months?
I think it's days. It's certainly not months. I can't imagine it being weeks. It could be a week or several days that we would spend in their offices. And where we were doing it PCOB-based, then we would, schedule phone calls and conferences at a convenient time, and that would probably wind up taking parts of a couple of days.
Okay. We've mentioned several times or discussed the enforcement activities and the findings, and how will a broker-dealer auditor know that we just something that maybe doesn't rise to a level of an enforcement action, but know when we have seen something that we don't think they did it right?
To the extent that we have that we identify deficiencies or concerns with their work, we would either communicate those orally if they're less significant, or communicate those using a comment form, which is a tool we use in doing the inspections of issuers. The firm would then have the opportunity to respond to our comment. And given that we would not be issuing firm-specific reports under this program, we would plan to communicate back to the firm, likely orally, our conclusions with respect to their response to the comment form, whether we found it persuasive or not persuasive and why.
And if we saw something that after this going back and forth, we said, gee, we really think you should have done more work or done something different, we would tell them that and expect them to do something about it?
Certainly. We would tell it to them, but we would probably not see them again until such time as they came up for inspection under a permanent program, if that were the case for their class of audits.
Okay. Thanks. Mr. Chairman?
Well, first, I would like from the chair to thank the board, as the comments and the questions illustrate. My colleagues have devoted a lot of thought, careful thought, to the details and implications of this interim rule. I always come to these meetings, and whenever I meet with this board, I always learn things and find the conversation stimulating. To turn to something that Dan Gelzer mentioned, we do have, we're told, a number of investment advisor auditors who want to be able to represent, to audit investment advisors, and are seeking to satisfy the requirement that they be subject to PCAOB inspections. I take it, therefore, one of the interesting things that will come out of this is whether, in fact, auditors who would otherwise be entitled to any exemption that we might create in some cases may decide they want to remain subject to PCAOB registration and inspection and not assert the exemption in order to audit registered investment advisors. Kind of an interesting aspect of this, but happily not our decision, something we'll learn. If there's no further discussion, I'm going to put the question to the board. Would those in favor of approving the motion to adopt the rule on the interim inspection program for broker-dealers, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion is carried. Thanks again to the staff. We'll turn now to what I think is the more straightforward part of this, which is the second item of the agenda, and that's the recommendation that the board adopt amendments to its funding rule.
Thank you again, Chairman Doty. And while the staff change seats, let me just say that on behalf of the Office of General Counsel, I'm also pleased to recommend today that the board adopt amendments to its funding rules. Since its inception, the board's primary source of revenue has been what the Sarbanes-Oxley Act calls the board's accounting support fee. As required by the Act, the accounting support fee has been allocated among public companies and investment companies based on their relative equity market capitalizations. As we've been discussing today, the Dodd-Frank Act assigned the board the additional responsibility to oversee the audits of brokers and dealers. To pay for that oversight, Dodd-Frank directs the board to allocate its accounting support fee among not only public companies and investment companies, but also among broker-dealers. The rules we're recommending today would implement these provisions of Dodd-Frank by providing for a portion of the board's accounting support fee to be allocated to brokers and dealers. We're also recommending today that the board make certain changes to its existing rules related to the part of the accounting support fee that will continue to be assessed to public companies and investment companies. These changes are based on 8 years now of experience administering the funding rules and the funding process, and are designed to make that process both more efficient and cost-effective for all concerned. Nina Majeri-Azad and Annie Braswell, Accounting Manager in the Office of Finance, will present the staff's recommendation. Before I turn the floor over to Nina and Annie, though, I'd like to acknowledge the work of both Annie and Nina, who I should say is Assistant General Counsel in the Office of General Counsel, as well as the work of Bob Burns, Associate General Counsel, on this rulemaking. And with that, let me turn it over to Nina to present the staff's recommendation.
Thank you, Gordon. Chairman Doty and members of the board, we are here today to recommend that the board adopt amendments to its funding rules to provide for a portion of the accounting support fee to be allocated among brokers and dealers. The rules we recommend today would only result in a fee being assessed to those brokers and dealers with average quarterly tentative net capital of greater than $5 million. We are also recommending that the board adopt amendments with respect to the allocation of the accounting support fee among issuers and related amendments to its Rule 1001. The funding rules adopted today would apply to the allocation of the 2011 broker-dealer accounting support fee, which we anticipate will take place in the fall of this year. The amendments related to issuers would take effect for the allocation of the 2012 issuer accounting support fee. The board received 8 comment letters on the proposed amendments to the rules. Commenters generally supported the amendments. Therefore, the rules before the board today are substantially similar to those proposed on December 14, 2010. The board proposed amendments to its funding rules in response to the Dodd-Frank Act, which amended Section 109 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act to require for the equitable allocation, assessment, and collection by the board of its accounting support fee among issuers and brokers and dealers. Starting with the board's 2011 budget, the total accounting support fee is divided into a broker-dealer accounting support fee and an issuer accounting support fee. I will now highlight how the broker-dealer accounting support fee will be allocated among brokers and dealers pursuant to the funding rules before the board today. First, explaining the basis for the allocation. Second, discussing the differentiation among classes of brokers and dealers for funding purposes. And third, describing the assessment and collection process applicable to the fee. The funding rules before the board today are consistent with the requirements in the Dodd-Frank Act that broker-dealer accounting support fee be allocated among brokers and dealers or classes of brokers and dealers based on their relative net capital before or after any adjustments, compared to the total net capital of all brokers and dealers before or after any adjustments. The reference to adjustments in relation to the net capital permits the board to allocate the fee based on tentative net capital, which is net capital before deducting certain securities haircuts and changes in inventory used in calculating the net capital of a broker or dealer. Because the investment decisions made by a broker or dealer can influence the amount of these deductions and thus influence the net capital calculation, tentative net capital may be a more consistent and equitable basis for the allocation of the broker-dealer accounting support fee than net capital. Accordingly, the basis for the allocation of the broker-dealer accounting support fee under the rules will be the broker or dealer's tentative net capital. The rules, if adopted, would create 2 classes of brokers and dealers for funding purposes based on whether the broker or dealer files financial statements with the commission, and if it does, on the amount of the broker's or dealer's tentative net capital. By differentiating brokers and dealers by class, which is allowed under the Dodd-Frank Act, the board is able to allocate the broker-dealer accounting support fee to those brokers and dealers whose audits, due to their relative size and complexity, may require more board time and resources during an inspection than other audits of brokers and dealers with relatively small and less complex operations. Brokers and dealers who are required to file audited financial statements and have average quarterly tentative net capital greater than $5 million will fall under Class 1. Those brokers will be assessed a proportionate share of the broker-dealer accounting support fee. All other broker-dealers will fall under Class 2 and will be assessed of the fee equal to zero, which basically means they will not receive an invoice and they will not pay any fee. Based on data received from FINRA, the vast majority of tentative net capital within the broker-dealer industry is concentrated in a relatively few brokers and dealers, with thousands of smaller broker-dealers having less than $5 million in tentative net capital. As a result, the staff anticipates that approximately 14% of the broker-dealer's population, or approximately 640 brokers and dealers, will fall in Class 1 and be assessed a share of the fee using the $5 million threshold. Following the allocation of the fee, the assessment and allocation process applicable to the fee will be similar to the process currently in place for issuers. For example, if a share of a broker-dealer accounting support fee allocated to a broker is past due and the broker has not filed a petition with the board seeking correction of its assigned share, then, with certain exceptions, no registered public accounting firm is permitted to sign an unqualified audit opinion with respect to the broker's financial statement or to sign a consent to the use of prior audit opinions for the broker. In addition, similar to issuers, brokers and dealers would be assessed monthly finance charges at a rate of 6% per year if they have an outstanding balance after 60 days of the date of their invoice. If the broker or dealer has an outstanding balance after the 90th day of the original invoice date, then the board may report the nonpayment to the commission or the broker's or dealer's designated examining authority. In addition to the funding rules related to brokers and dealers discussed above, we are recommending that the board adopt certain amendments to its existing rules for the allocation, assessment, and collection of the issuer accounting support fee. As you know, the board has conducted its funding under these rules since 2003. While the rules generally have functioned as intended, we believe that the allocation and assessment process could be more efficient in some respects. Annie will discuss most of the proposed amendments to the board's funding rules with respect to issuers. However, I would like to highlight one change for your attention. As required under Section 109 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the accounting support fee has been allocated among issuers based on their relative average monthly market capitalization. Under the board's current rules, an issuer's market capitalization is based on the aggregate market value of all classes of the issuer's common stock that trade in the United States. To reduce any interpretive issues as to whether certain types of securities not identified as common stock, such as limited partnership interests, should be included in an issuer's market capitalization, we recommend that the board amend the definition of issuer market capitalization and market capitalization of an issuer by replacing the reference to common stock with a reference to voting and non-voting common equity. Therefore, beginning in 2012, an issuer's market capitalization will be based on the issuer's aggregate market value of all classes of voting and non-voting common equity traded in the United States. The definition of common equity in the rules would track the definition of Rule 12b-2 under the Exchange Act, which includes any class of common stock or an equivalent interest, including but not limited to a unit of beneficial interest in a trust or a limited partnership interest, and any other security that the Commission, by rule, deems to treat as common equity. Preferred stock, warrants, and options would continue to be excluded when calculating an issuer's market capitalization for funding purposes. We do not believe this change will have a significant impact on the allocation of the fee for issuers. I would now like to turn it over to Annie, who will describe other amendments to the board's funding rules concerning issuers.
Thank you, Nina. In addition to the modification of the definition of issuer market capitalization, the amendments before the board propose an increase in market cap thresholds for issuer classes 1 and 2. Issuers in these classes are allocated portions of the issuer accounting support fee based on their relative average monthly market capitalizations. The amendments before the board would increase the market cap thresholds from $25 million to $75 million for Class 1 issuers, which includes public companies, and from $250 million to $500 million for Class 2 issuers, which includes investment companies. Under these revised thresholds, it is anticipated that approximately 1,100 less equity companies and approximately 1,450 less investment companies would be invoiced for a portion of the accounting support fee. We believe the increase in these thresholds allows for a more efficient funding process and reduces the administrative burden on smaller issuers with minimal effect on the fee assessments for other issuers. Additionally, we are proposing amendments to the consideration of issuers that are in bankruptcy and meet the modified reporting requirements of SEC Staff Legal Bulletin No. 2. These issuers are not required to file audited financial statements with the Commission, fall under the third class of issuers, and are allocated a portion of the accounting support fee equal to zero. In a number of instances, companies in bankruptcy who file modified reports will notify PCAOB staff that they meet the conditions for modified reporting under Staff Legal Bulletin No. 2 and should be allocated a share of the accounting support fee equal to zero. It is difficult, however, for PCAOB staff to verify such assertions since there is no requirement that an issuer receive no action relief from the SEC's Division of Corporation Finance prior to filing modified reports. To avoid PCAOB staff having to determine whether or not a bankrupt issuer meets the conditions set forth in Staff Legal Bulletin No. 2, the amendments before the Board today would clarify that an issuer in bankruptcy that asserts that it meets the modified reporting requirements must provide an opinion of counsel that the issuer met those requirements as of the date that the accounting support fee was calculated. Further, the amendments would extend the time frame within which an issuer, broker, or dealer may petition the Board for correction of the class in which it has been placed or its allocated share of the accounting support fee. In the past, the funding rules permitted petitions for correction to be received within 30 days of the invoice date. However, staff has found over the past funding cycles that issuers rarely deliver petitions to the Board within 30 days, and the staff has typically accepted and considered petitions past that date. The amendments extend the time frame in which issuers, brokers, or dealers may file a petition from 30 days to 60 days and would allow acceptance of petitions for correction past 60 days when good cause is shown. Finally, with regard to a registered accounting firm ascertaining that an issuer, broker, or dealer client has paid its share of the accounting support fee, the proposed amendments clarify that it is not mandatory that a registered accounting firm obtain confirmation from the Board that prior to signing an unqualified audit opinion, consenting to include an audit report issued previously, or signing a document, report, notice, or other record concerning procedures or controls of its issuer, broker, or dealer client. Rather, the firm may ascertain that its client has paid through various other means. As such, the amendments replace the word confirmation with the word determination in the caption for Rule 7104B and remove specific reference to obtaining confirmation from the Board. This modification is in recognition that confirmation is one of a number of procedures available to a registered public accounting firm when determining whether its client has an outstanding past due share of the accounting support fee. Under the Dodd-Frank amendments to the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, the PCAOB is required to begin allocation, assessment, and collection of the accounting support fee from brokers and dealers to fund the first full fiscal year after the date the Dodd-Frank Act was enacted, which is the 2011 calendar year. As such, we expect that subject to approval of the funding rules by the SEC, the funding rules would be effective for the 2011 funding cycle for brokers and dealers and for the 2012 funding cycle for issuers. We are recommending that the Board approve the funding rules and related amendments to Rule 1001 before you today and are happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Mujeriassad, Ms. Brasnell. Any motions on this matter?
Mr. Chairman, I have a motion.
Mr. Hanson.
I move that the Board adopt the amendments to the Board's funding rules and related amendments to Rule 1001 as recommended by the staff and instruct the staff to submit the amendments to the Securities and Exchange Commission for approval pursuant to Section 107 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act.
Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Person. First, I want to acknowledge again the hard work of the staff who brought this project to fruition, including in particular Bob Burns, Nina Mujeriassad, and Annie Braswell. We appreciate this work. I want to follow the good example of my colleague, Mr. Harris, and ask that my statement be included in the record and merely note two points that the staff has made. One is that we will be allocating zero and not billing our broker dealer with less than $5 million of tentative net capital, and that's going to eliminate a burden for almost all of the small brokers and dealers. And then, not to be overlooked, for issuers other than investment companies, there are 1,100 small issuers who will no longer be receiving any bill at all from us for any part of our support fee as a result of increasing the threshold. With that discussion, I want to turn to my fellow board members for discussion. Mr. Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I will make a brief statement and then also ask some questions. The funding rules create a framework for obtaining the resources to support the board's new responsibilities to oversee the auditors of securities brokers and dealers. The rules, as we've heard, will also raise the threshold so that public companies with market capitalizations below $75 million will no longer pay PCOB support fees. In both cases, the result is that the largest companies and brokerages, that is, those whose financial reporting has the greatest potential impact on the investing public, will bear the lion's share of the board's costs. When Congress created the PCOB in 2002, it charged the board with oversight of all U.S. public companies and provided that the board's work should be funded by those public companies. Last summer, in the Dodd-Frank Act, Congress expanded the board's responsibilities, as we've already discussed, to include securities broker-dealers and extended the self-funding approach to require that broker-dealers pay those costs in proportion to their net capital. Broker-dealer net capital is highly concentrated. Of the 4,600 or so firms that are FINRA members, or for which FINRA is the examining authority or the financial review authority, just 1% of 33 firms, actually less than 1%, hold 80% of all the tentative net capital. The great majority of the firms are very small. And in fact, under any allocation methodology that we might come up with, thousands of firms would pay no support fee at all simply because we round bills to the nearest $100 and many would round to zero under really any feasible allocation methodology. The new funding rules provide that only broker-dealers with tentative net capital in excess of $5 million will pay a share of the support fee. About 640 firms, around 14%, exceed that threshold. Last year, the board estimated that about 7% of its budget this year, that is around $14.5 million, would be devoted to broker-dealer oversight. So applying the new methodology to that budget number, the support fee assessments that will go to brokerage firms will range from a low of $400 to a high of a little over $1 million. About 100 firms will pay $500 or less, and only 3 will pay over $1 million. The board has the authority to exempt the auditors of classes of broker-dealers from board oversight. We've already discussed that at some length this morning, and we'll be making decisions about that as we gather more information through the interim inspection program. However, in my view, few, if any, of the larger broker-dealers that will be paying the support fee are likely to find that their auditors will ultimately be exempted from PCOB oversight. The staff is also recommending changes to the rules related to public company support fees. The biggest practical effect of those changes will be the increase in the market capitalization threshold. Currently, all public companies with market capitalizations of at least $25 million must contribute to the board's funding of its issuer oversight program. That threshold will now raise to $75 million. The result, as Chairman Doty has said, is that about 1,100 issuers, that's about 23% of all the issuers that were assessed this year, will no longer be subject to the support fee. Granting that relief to those 1,100 companies only has a very small effect on those that are left paying the support fee, because the those that are going to be exempted were only paying about 0.4% of the total assessment to begin with. The rule revisions would also increase the market capitalization or net asset threshold from $250 million to $500 million for investment companies. That eliminates about 1,480 investment companies, roughly a third of all the investment companies that were assessed this year from the assessment program. The broker-dealer funding rules and the changes to the public company funding rules implement Congress's objective of requiring public companies and broker-dealers to provide the resources for the board's oversight of their auditors. I believe the rules will accomplish that goal without burdening smaller public companies, smaller broker-dealers, and smaller investment companies, and I certainly support the funding rule changes. These amendments were a joint effort, as we've heard, of the Office of the General Counsel and the Office of Finance, so I'd like to join the chairman in thanking Bob Burns and Nina Mojari-Assad from the General Counsel's Office for their work, and Annie Braswell, Manager of Accounting in the Finance Office, for her work on this project. Let me ask you just a couple of things about these rules. As I just mentioned, late last year, we estimated that we'd spend about $14.4 million this year on broker-dealer oversight, and so that's the number that will be used in cranking out the broker-dealer assessments this year. The year's half over. I guess we can't change that number, but do we still think that's a good estimate of what our costs will be this year?
Yeah, I think to answer that question, we're going to ask Bill Wiggins from the Budget Office to come on up.
The $14.4 million was based on a high-level allocation methodology, as you indicated, as part of last year's budget process. The majority of that amount related to headcount, primarily in inspections and related costs, travel, et cetera. Although we're halfway through the year, we don't have a better estimate at this time, and part of that relates to the timing of when we thought the staff would come on board this year. And the staff were the projected timing was weighted toward the second half of this year, so we're really starting to get into the time now where we'll be able to ascertain how accurate that number is or projection was.
Yeah, I appreciate the back-ending element. I mean, hopefully as we go forward with this program and other aspects of our operations evolve, we'll get better and better at making these estimates going forward. I guess we've all said now that we think about 640 brokerage firms will be assessed this year. Do we have any information about the demographics of those, what I'll call the demographics of those firms? For example, are any of them introducing firms with that don't have custody of client assets, or any of them don't have public clients because they're captives or something of that nature?
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have any specific demographics for those particular firms. We have been receiving data from FINRA, from other organizations of brokers and dealers, and so we do know that there are several, as you mentioned a while ago, that broker-dealers who focus on particular types of business. Some just sell mutual funds, some just sell annuities, some are floor traders, some do a variety of different things. Some are mergers and acquisitions, some are just do private placements. There's a variety of business lines they're in. Not all of them are introducing, or not all of them are clearing and carrying. I think, though, from the data we received so far, though we can't isolate to particular firms at this point, I think that it's reasonable to assume that, as you're saying before, most of the 640, the larger ones, are going to be clearing and carrying, or the ones that are going to be involved somehow or another with dealing with customer funds or assets.
I just made the statement that I thought it was unlikely that the firms that were being assessed would find that their auditors would ultimately be exempted from PCAOB oversight. I don't know whether you guys agree with that or not, but I guess maybe the point I would ask is there isn't any connection between those two things, as you could have a situation where your auditor was not subject to PCAOB oversight, but you, the broker, were still paying an assessment. Is that correct?
Well, if the board eventually decides, if I understand the question right, if the board eventually decides to exempt certain categories of brokers, dealer, or auditors of broker-dealers from an inspection program, and so they have the chance to deregister, do in fact deregister, and their broker-dealer audit clients would not really have to pay any fee. And the reason for that basically goes back to the definition of broker-dealer in Sarbanes-Oxley, because Sarbanes-Oxley takes the Exchange Act definition of broker-dealer and then adds to that the requirement that they actually have to have financial statements that are audited by a PCAOB-registered auditor. So when you get down to actually the funding part of it, where you use the term broker, you're excluding those that don't have to hire a PCAOB-registered broker. So that's kind of a long story. Maybe you didn't want the longest word. But the net effect is if you let them out of the inspection program, their clients are not going to have to pay the fee.
Well, I wish I'd asked you that question before the meeting. I might have to revise and extend my my prior remarks to fix that point. I guess some I'll call them entities have a different kind of issue, that you may have a public company, holding company, and then a broker dealer subsidiary, or even multiple broker dealer subsidiaries. So I take it that firms in that position, entities in those position, in that position could be paying two assessments, maybe even three or four assessments, depending upon their structure.
That's correct. An entity that the holding company falls under, the issuer, would be subject to the issuer accounting support fee, and any broker-dealer subsidiary below that parent would also be subject to the broker-dealer accounting support fee if they meet the thresholds that the board has established under the rules. In those situations, we believe that's appropriate because the inspection of the issuer audit is separate from the inspection of the broker-dealer work that we would be looking at.
Do we have any information about how many public companies have multiple broker-dealer affiliates?
Not currently, but we do anticipate that there are several large financial institutions that would fall under that category where they would have one or maybe multiple broker-dealer subsidiaries. And I'd like to just point out that when there are multiple broker-dealer subsidiaries under the issuer, each broker-dealer would be assessed the fee based on its own individual tentative net capital. We will not be accumulating those together.
Okay, well, let me turn to something a little different. I mean, I take it that the main way we enforce this rule, if I want to put it that way, is that Rule 7104 says that if the client hasn't paid its support fee, has a past due support fee, then the auditor can't sign an audit opinion with respect to that issuer. There is an exception to that provision. But how will that work in this world of sort of families of issuers and broker-dealers? In other words, if the issuer has paid the fee, can the issuer's auditor sign its audit report even if the broker-dealer subsidiaries haven't, and vice versa?
In a situation where you have a parent sub-relationship and the subsidiary broker-dealer has a past due outstanding fee, we would interpret that the rules the rules that are being proposed today would prohibit the auditor of the issuer parent from also signing an unqualified opinion if the broker-dealer subsidiary has a past due outstanding fee. So the impact of the outstanding past due broker-dealer of the broker subsidiary's fee would have an upstream effect. And it would only be an upstream effect, meaning that in a situation where the parent has not paid its issuer accounting support fee, it would not have effect on the auditor of the broker-dealer subsidiary.
Yeah, the idea is basically that if you have a broker-dealer that hasn't paid, the issuer may be able to help persuade the broker-dealer to come out and pay it, where that may not work in reverse. Yeah. So that's the basic philosophy.
And not to get too esoteric, but if a sister affiliate hasn't paid its fee?
We don't see that being a brother-sister relationship.
So that brings up the question of how the auditor is supposed to figure out if the fee was paid. And our rule has a note in it that says they can accept a representation, or may ascertain that there's no support fee due based on a representation from the issuer. Commenters asked us to insert the word solely into that note so that it would say based solely on a representation from the issuer. But we declined to do that. So what does that mean, that the word solely isn't there?
We did not believe that the insertion of solely was appropriate, as we did not want to limit the procedures that the auditor may perform in ascertaining whether his or her client has an outstanding share of the accounting support fee. there are multiple procedures available to the auditor. One is to obtain a representation from his or her client. Others may include asking for a confirmation from the board, or going on our website and looking at the list of entities without any shares of outstanding fee.
If I get a representation, you know, conventional representation from management of the issuer, that the fee's been paid, do I have to do something else besides being aware of the fact that the board declined to insert the word solely into that note?
We've previously stated that a representation from your client is sufficient. However, if there's contradictory evidence that the auditor finds, they would have to, just as in any other case, investigate that information and determine what the ultimate resolution is.
Okay, so it's sort of a red flag test. In other words, I can't accept the representation if I have some red flag that it might not be.
That's right. Adequate.
And
Specter case lives.
I guess that's right. You mentioned two other interesting things, the list and confirmation from the board. We put up a list now of issuers that have paid the support fee. Are we going to put up a list of brokers that have paid the support fee also?
Yes, we plan to put up a list of issuers or broker-dealers that have been assessed a portion of the broker-dealer accounting support fee and have paid in full, similar to the issuer list.
Because I guess if you look and your client isn't on the list, then you still have to figure out whether that means they haven't paid or whether they just simply weren't required to pay because there's so many exempt.
That's true. And at any time, they can reach out to us for confirmation.
Oh, good. I'm glad you mentioned that. Because the note, I believe the note currently says that obtaining confirmation from the board is one way to ascertain whether the support fee has been made. But we're deleting that from the note, are we not? What are people supposed to take away from that?
The point there is that confirmation or representation from the client is one way of getting or determining if a company has paid their accounting support fee assessment. But in addition, we do intend to proceed with providing confirmations upon request from issuers, brokers or dealers, or their auditors.
Why are we taking it out? I mean, if we're still going to do it and it's still a valid way of getting an answer to the question, what's the meaning of taking it out of the note?
The deletion was merely to indicate that confirmation was not the only means, but actually one of many. So we just didn't want auditors to think that by us using the word confirmation, that was the only way they could ascertain whether their clients have any outstanding fees.
One last thing. There, we mentioned that there's an exception to Rule 7104, which basically says that to make a regulatory filing or engage in a capital raising transaction on a one-time basis, the auditor can sign, notwithstanding that the issuer, or now the broker, hasn't paid the fee. But if I have this all straight, formerly the issuer had to give us notice that it happened. Now we're switching to the auditor having to give us notice that had happened. And people didn't like that in the comments. I mean, the auditors who commented, I think, felt that this should remain an issuer responsibility and the requirement shouldn't be transferred to them. And what's the thinking in making that change?
Right. The auditing firms generally did not think that was a good idea.
Yeah.
I think the reason that we're doing it basically is the fact that, to be perfectly honest, there have not been all that many notices filed over the years, and I think one of the reasons for that might be the fact that issuers just aren't that familiar with the rules, and they aren't accustomed to looking into the PCAOB rules for things that they need to do. And it's much easier for the auditor to be aware of the requirement, to know the implications of not filing it, and to make sure that the notice gets in on time and to the right people. And we'll be able to check that when we go out for inspections and to see what's going on with the actual application of the rule.
Well, yeah, that's the charitable explanation. The nicer explanation might be that issuers have no fear of us since we can't do anything to them, so why should they comply with our rules? What will happen if an auditor doesn't file one of these notices? Would that potentially be an enforcement matter?
Well, the rule says that the auditor can only sign an unqualified opinion if they ascertain that the fee has been paid. So if the fee has not been paid and they sign an unqualified opinion, there's been a violation of the PCOB rule, which would be subject to disciplinary action.
But couldn't there be a situation where the not signing was in compliance with the exception? So it was okay to sign.
Well,
the
it's only okay to sign.
Notice should have been given to us, but wasn't.
Well, it's only okay to sign if you meet the conditions of the rule, and the notice coming in would be one of the conditions of the rule. So you don't qualify to get the exception unless you meet all the conditions.
So the signing would be a violation of our rules in that case, and at least theoretically subject to
Yes.
Would the filing be invalid in some way, or the audit opinion?
That's something that the SEC would have to.
In the 34 Act?
That's something the SEC, I think, would have to decide as to whether or not they continue to accept the filing or whether or not they want to do anything with it. That's.
We need the phone number for the Chief Counsel's Office of Corporation Finance, or maybe the Office of Chief Counsel. Thank you very much.
Board Member Harris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support these funding rules and will put my comments in the record. Very briefly, I would like to emphasize in particular, as you have, Mr. Chairman, and Dan has, that these funding rules are considerate of the likely burden on small firms. You've clearly taken that into account, and I think that's extremely important. The rules also provide the same sort of relief for public companies and investment companies. Specifically, the market capitalization thresholds will be raised from what they were under the previous funding rules, and as a result, the number of companies that do not receive an invoice from the PCOB will increase. In sum, I think the staff has done a terrific job on a very technical issue, which I appreciate. I just have one question, and that is, for the record, how did you decide on only two classes of brokers and dealers for funding purposes?
When we were looking at when we were coming before the board in December, we had looked at the broker-dealer data that we had received from FINRA and determined what would be the population of broker-dealers being assessed using no threshold or various other thresholds. And under the no threshold, as Dan mentioned, because of our rounding, a substantial number of the broker-dealer population would still not be assessed a fee. Comparing that to a $5 million threshold, it would appear that about 900 broker-dealers would not get assessed under the $5 million threshold, but that only represents 1% of the fee being redistributed to the 640. So we thought that's the analysis that we went through, and we proposed a $5 million threshold.
Thank you very much. Board Member Ferguson.
Mr. Chairman, I'd also like to put my records, my comments in the record and say that I support the adoption of this rule. I would also note that I think it's a testament to the staff's thoughtful analysis in dividing brokers into two classes that the commenters on this basically supported this allocation. I think it also shows pretty clearly that the board is very sensitive to imposing burdens on small firms. And I also support, appreciate very much the hard work and very thoughtful work that you all did in coming up with this. And I have two questions. One, when we are calculating these fees and looking at average quarterly tentative net capital, I assume we do that by looking at public filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Is that where we get that information?
We anticipate that we'll be getting the data from FINRA and the designated and other self-regulating organizations that the broker-dealers are registered with and file reports with. The information will be coming from focus reports, but that information is not public.
Okay. So this will be private information that's filed with their regulatory information.
Yes.
But they will be provided to us.
Yes.
The second question is for issuers, where we've now changed the threshold for issuers for purposes of the allocating the accounting support fee, have you calculated to what extent for those issuers who remain and will be continuing to pay this fee, to what extent by what average percentage will their fees go up? Do you know that?
Yeah. As noted previously, the amount assessed to the 1,100 issuers that would likely not receive a bill going forward, public companies, only 0.4% or less of the accounting support fee was allocated to that group. Similarly, for investment companies, which on average have only been assessed about 5% of the total accounting support fee, the total accounting support fee assessed to that group that would be excluded was only 0.3% of the accounting support fee.
This should almost be not noticeable.
Those tiny percentages would be redistributed over the other issuers, and the increases would be very minimal.
So this will be a tremendous saving both to those people and to us in terms of the administrative
correct
effort.
Correct. Yes.
Board Member Anderson.
I have no formal statement or further questions other than to thank the staff and express my support for the proposal today.
If there's no further question, no further discussion, I'll put the question to the board. Are all those in favor of approving the funding rule, please say aye.
Aye.
And any opposed? The ayes have it. The motion carried. The rule is passed. Thank you to the staff again and to the board. That concludes our agenda. The meeting is now adjourned. And we can take perhaps a 5-minute break, a 10-minute break, and reconvene here for some non-public work. Thank you.